Welcome to Delmarva Radio Theater. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Our play today is titled Habits of Devotion. It's about sin and forgiveness. Two very religious boys driving a long-haul beer delivery truck for H&F Distributing, Inc., pick up a young girl at her uncle's house in Charleston, South Carolina. They are to deliver her to her aunt in Charlotte on their beer route. But the uncle isn't really her uncle, and she announces she isn't going to her aunt in North Carolina. What she reveals to the two boys is startling and challenging to the faith of both boys. Two of the main characters in the play are the narrator and the young girl, Elmira Foley. We're fortunate to have Mike Murphy, who takes the part of the narrator, and Judy Hearn, who plays Elmira Foley, in the studio for a short interview today. Both are members of the Community Players of Salisbury, and both have appeared in a number of Delmarva Radio Theater productions. Mike, let me begin with you. I understand you were a theater major at University, Notre Dame, I believe, and went on to become a medical doctor. How did that work? I thought doctors began their studies right off these days, sometimes even in high school with AP courses in science that they took. How is it that you majored in theater and then went on to medical school?
It's not as rare as you would think. It's changed somewhat since I went to school. We won't say how long ago, but you have to have a set of group of classes that you take, a biology, chemistry, organic chemistry, some science classes that you have to take. And I actually started down that path. One of the reasons I went to Notre Dame is because they have such a fantastic pre-med program. But when I got there, I started doing theater, which I'd done in high school and had done in junior high school, and thought I wasn't sure that I wanted to be a doctor. And so I kind of put that aside for several years and became a theater major.
So you had Broadway in your sights, or what was your long-range goal?
I think every 19-year-old that's a theater major thinks they're going to Broadway.
Oh, okay. Well, of course.
That, and then reality starts to – then you become a senior, and then you're out of college and start to think about how – you start to realize how difficult it is. I had a friend who was much more talented than I was who ended up going back to law school, and he said, I just wasn't sure how many dog food commercials I wanted to do.
So is that the first step, is doing commercials?
I guess that's what he thought it was. I mean, for me, to be honest, I didn't really give acting much of a go after college. I didn't give it much of a chance.
So theater kind of went away after you got serious about your medical studies?
Well, yes, it did. And what happened, I had auditioned from Notre Dame. I had auditioned for an MFA program, a Master of Fine Arts in Theater, and was accepted to it. And it came down to sort of the last day, and my heart wasn't in it. I decided not to do it. And so I did a number of other things even before I went to medical school. And finally, I think I went back to medical school thinking about it about almost 8 years after I graduated college.
Well, in terms of theater and medical school, when did these two come back together for you?
Well, I went in terms of the theater. I stopped doing anything probably in the early 90s. I'd worked in some theater as a technical position in Washington, D.C., I did lighting and technical stuff at Arena Stage, and then just sort of whatever I could find in the area. And when I decided to go back to medical school, I just stopped doing all that until just a few years ago. And you go to medical school, and the work there is overwhelming. The idea of having time to do theater is not possible. And then I got married, and we had kids, and my kids were little, and I spent time with them and went to their productions and went to things with them. And my boys went to college, and my daughter a few years ago said, you know, you always did theater and you always talk about community players. Why aren't you auditioning? And then I would say, well, I just don't have time. And then when my second son went to college and she looked at me and said, you've got nothing but time. I'm fine. Go audition for a show. And so I did.
And that was with the community players mm-hmm. of Salisbury here in here in Salisbury.
Yes.
And that got you hooked again in the theater?
Yeah, it doesn't take much. I think I've done 6 shows since then.
Is that right?
Yeah. And lucky enough to meet you through them and have done a few shows on the radio.
And what kind of medical work are you doing?
I work in the emergency department at PRMC.
And what does that mean?
Well, I'm a physician there, and just sort of whatever comes to the emergency department, then we take care of that. Any patient who comes in with whatever complaint.
How does what is the relationship, or is there any in your life between your medical work and your aptitude for medicine and interest and desire for medicine and a rather different aptitude for theater and an interest in theater? Do these two marry at all, or are they completely separate?
No, I think there is a good marriage there. I think at the heart of both fields is really a love of personal interaction and an ability to interact with people. I think your best physicians are those that can sit down at somebody's bedside and look them in the eye and talk to them about whatever they're there for that day. And the ability to be comfortable in that role of just sitting down with people and interacting. And in theater, it seems like it's different because there's so many people. But really, if you talk to any actor, the idea is really to really connect with an individual who's watching the show as opposed to connecting with. You can't always try to connect with 800 people at a time or however many people are there.
How about connecting with the part that you're playing?
Well, you mean are they related in the two fields, or is that what do you mean?
Well, you relate to people, but at the same time now, when you're playing a role, you've got a different personality that you not only need to react to, you've got to incorporate. You've got to become to a degree that person.
Yes.
So how does that play out for you?
Well, I think anytime you're playing somebody other than yourself, there's a fun aspect to that. And you really want to make it as different from yourself as possible. And that's one of the things you learn as you do theater, or, you know, as a theater major, you learn how to use your body as an instrument and your voice as an instrument, and learn how to find context within the text to tell you who that character is, their interactions with other characters in the show. The other characters in the show will always talk about that character, and you learn who that person is as you sort of flesh that out, reading the script and then interacting with the other actors.
For any other doctor who might be listening who would want to broaden their relationship to the community, what would you advise them about theater?
Oh, I think if they can get involved with that. I do see people that come in and they say, I saw you in that show. You were that guy on the stage. And yeah, that was me. And there is some fun aspect to that, and certainly meeting other people in the community. I think that there's a humanity that comes from it that people appreciate.
What's your favorite role that you have played? All the theater productions.
Any comedic role,
done.
I think, is probably the most fun.
Oh, no. Which comedic role?
Oh,
can you name? Can you pull one of them that is important to you still today?
I don't know that I have any specific one that I can pull out of. That's tough. That's a difficult question.
Yeah.
You know, any time you are able to make people laugh, which is very difficult to do. You know, even just last year, I did Death of a Salesman, which is a terribly depressing play.
Willie Loman is not a big guy.
But I played the neighbor, who's sort of the comedic relief, and being able to have those interactions was neat. I mean, that's fun.
Well, let me turn to Judy Hearn. Now, Judy, you have what I consider a very demanding role in this drama that we're going to hear in a few minutes. The role of this young girl, Elmira Foley. And without giving away the plot and what happens to Elmira here, what struck you as you studied the part? What struck you about Elmira? What struck you about her character?
Okay. Well, as I read through it, the first thing that came to my mind was Maella Yule in To Kill a Mockingbird. I thought it was a very similar character who kind of deflects her own feelings and kind of reacts to things in a sexual way and maybe falsely accuses and all that sort of thing, and wanting to know why she is that way, which in this story we certainly find out why Elmira is very much like that, which I understand that the Broadway production of To Kill a Mockingbird delves into that much more than the film. You learn a lot more about Maella, and it makes her a little bit more of a sympathetic character. So having talked with my friend Sharon Benchoff about that, I thought that was perfect for how to play Elmira. Hopefully it went okay. We'll find out.
We're going to find out, and I have no doubts. You are a member of the Community Players of Salisbury as well. Tell us a little bit about your history with the Community Players of Salisbury.
Okay. Well, this is my ninth year with them, and the group has actually been around for 80-plus years. I'm not quite that elderly, but close. The way I got started was actually in my film class. I was a teacher at Del Mar High School for 20 years, and I had a class called History of Cinema, and one of my students in there asked me to come see one of his shows. He was doing a show with Community Players. It was All Shook Up, a musical. And my feeling was, it's community theater. It's not going to be good. But just to make this kid happy, I'll go. And was blown away, just absolutely blown away. It was such a Broadway caliber show. And I thought, oh my goodness, I've done theater in college. It's time for me to try. So I asked this kid, I said, next time you've got any kind of auditions going on that's not a musical, because I cannot sing, will you let me know? And he came running into my room after school one day and said, oh my gosh, the auditions are tomorrow for... for this show. And there's no singing, but here you go. So a last minute thing, I got to go in and try out for a show called Tom, Dick, and Harry, which was hilarious, a British show. And Sharon Benchoff was the director of that. And it was a tremendous show. And well, there you go. As Mike said, you're just instantly hooked again. And so I've been in many, many shows since then. And if I'm not on the stage, for instance, when we do musicals, I do the set. So I'm either painting or I'm acting or sometimes both.
Well, we got Notre Dame with Mike here. Where did you go to college, and what kind of theater work did you do when you were at university?
Okay. I went to Shepherd University, which is a much smaller place than Notre Dame, but I was paying for school myself out of my own pocket, so I could afford that. And it was the same sort of thing where a speech teacher that I had said, you have a beautiful voice, you should absolutely audition for shows. And so I did and got the lead in Tartuffe, which was not expected. And that's where I started.
Not in French.
Not in French, but I was very familiar with it because I'd learned it in French. So I was thrilled to get to do that. And then, of course, since I was an art major, they asked me to work on the set, and there you go. So again, the same sort of thing. If it wasn't a musical, I was on the stage or painting the set.
Well, I want to ask you the similar question to the one that I asked Mike. Out of all of the roles that you have played, what is your favorite role?
I actually do have a favorite. And it was a few years ago, I guess 4 years ago, and it was the show called The Man Who Came to Dinner, and I played Lorraine Sheldon. And she was a riot to play because she had no redeeming qualities whatsoever, but was hysterically funny. And she ended up getting, in the end, closed into a sarcophagus, which I had actually made. So that was fun.
Give us a little bit, if you would, for both of you, the nature of doing radio theater. I know both of you have great experience doing live, I'll call it live theater for want of a better technical term. how do you find the projection or whatever difference between live theater and radio. And let me begin with you, Mike.
I think it's much more intimate. I mean, that part of it is probably obvious. Working on a theater, on a stage, you're projecting to the last row. And so you're much broader, and your facial expressions are much bigger, and your voice is much louder. And sort of in this surrounding, it's much more intimate. And I think that's the biggest thing. Your voice doesn't have to be as loud. And in fact, there's a lot more subtlety. I mean, even when we recorded this, I remember stopping and we sort of, let's try that a little different. And the differences there, the nice parts about being able to stop in the middle and go again is also good. But those subtleties, and I remember as a kid, my dad was from Kansas City. We lived in Denver and drove across Kansas, and we would listen to radio shows like this every time we crossed. And I just remember, I just loved it so much. And that intimacy, not many people probably listen to this in their car anymore, but there is that, I always think about that, and who are we projecting to? I'm projecting to the kid sitting in the back seat who's listening to this on his dad's radio. It's really neat.
And you do bring up the great benefits of editing our radio are just wonderful. Judy.
Yes. Well, each acting experience is a little bit different. When I'm done film or television work, there is that editing effect that you can go in if you've screwed up and do it over. Although when you're doing a scene and you have to do it 500 times, that gets a little annoying. But you don't have to memorize any lines, just like this. So there's that advantage. Theater is always going to be a favorite just because of the audience reaction. You immediately get feedback from the audience. But radio is nice because you don't have to throw your voice. And it's more like you're just sitting in a room with friends having a conversation.
Well, I want to thank both of you very much for making yourselves available in the studio here today to talk about Habits of Devotion, our drama coming up. And thank you for a great job you did of narrating, Mike. And thank you for the brilliant, I think, anyway, performance of Elmira. Our listeners are in for a treat from both of you. And now to our drama, Habits of Devotion.
On a clear winter morning in January 1957, Billy Fitzgerald ended his studies for the priesthood and withdrew from St. Joseph Seminary College in St. Benedict, Louisiana. He returned home to Charleston, South Carolina, and took up a job driving a beer truck. It wasn't the rigor of academic studies, and certainly not any lack of religious devotion or commitment, that caused Billy to leave St. Joseph. Like nothing else, Billy wanted to be a priest. There was only his mother who wanted it more. She raised her son for religious office, and throughout his youth, it was the only future he knew. Certainly, it was the only future his mother knew for him. When Billy told her he was home to stay, that he wasn't going back to Louisiana, she looked at him across the kitchen table, balled up her napkin, and didn't say a word. Then she slumped in her chair, fingered her coffee cup as though it was a chalice of hemlock, and heaved a sigh of defeat, a sigh so deep that it filled the kitchen with a cloud of despair, a sigh so sustained it wound its way out the kitchen window, across Charleston and around the world, a sigh so heavy it touched every mother across the globe and prompted her to lift her head from what she was doing and stare into the distance. The youngest of three boys, Billy had been her last hope. The oldest boy was now a used car salesman in Stark, Florida. The next one went to university and was a college professor teaching something called rhetoric at Price College in North Georgia. And now Billy. Still without speaking, Mrs. Fitzgerald left the kitchen table and went upstairs to her bedroom. In the heavy oak dresser, pushed hard against the wall, in a drawer behind clothes she hadn't touched in years, Mrs. Fitzgerald found a small olive wood box with a cross carved on the lid. She held the box for a moment, then with another sigh, this one of resignation, slid the box into the pocket of her apron. In the kitchen, she pushed the box across the table to Billy.
It's the rosary, Billy. Your grandfather carved the beads from olive wood he got from Bethlehem. You have it. I was saving it for your ordination, but you may as well have it now.
Billy lifted the five-decade rosary from the box and cradled it in his hand. On the inside of the cover, his grandfather had carved a likeness of Pope Pius V, and on each bead a relief of one of the saints. The beads were worn and dark from oil passed from his grandfather's fingers. Billy could imagine him in Ireland, in a smoky cottage, saying his prayers before the peat bog fire.
You have to promise me, Billy, to say the rosary at least once each day for the rest of your life, or at least for as long as you're able.
And she reached across the table and closed Billy's fingers on the gathering of beads in his fist. The beads were heavy in Billy's hand. They carried the promise of the church, but they also carried the weight of his failure.
Yes, Mom. I promise.
Billy was a child of the church, his mother's child of the church. He loved to go to Mass. The dressing up, the colors, the pageantry, the sacred paintings and the vessels used in the Mass. He especially loved that moment in the great drama when the priest turned the bread and wine into the actual flesh and blood of Jesus. Was it magic or was it a mystery? He really didn't believe in magic, so it must be a mystery he wasn't really meant to understand. Billy even loved the Latin. That was part of the mystery for him, the flowing, mysterious sound of this language he didn't understand. He knew what it said, though, and embraced the story it told. But it was the Latin, pure and simple as that, the mysterious sound of this language he loved, that language carried forward by the ancient church for its own political and ecclesiastical ends, that language of select power, recording forever the sacred thoughts of the church fathers, and carried on by medieval philosophers, the universal language that gave the world five great Romance languages. This language of beauty and mystery was Billy's downfall. You see, Billy couldn't learn the Latin. No matter how hard he tried, practiced his declensions, read aloud, memorized verbs, it just wouldn't stick. Like water in a tight mesh screen, it would pool and circle for a moment, tease the memory, but then verbs, nouns, direct objects, connections, agreements, meaning, all would drip slowly away until there was nothing left. This was 1957. And in the Catholic Church of the 1950s, this was no small matter. Not only was the Mass said in Latin, but it was also a staple of theological and administrative communication in the Church. In short, it was the official vehicle for verbal and written expression. Not only was it used in the services of the Church, all the business correspondence of the Holy See, encyclicals and briefs of the popes, all the decrees and regulations that were promulgated, everything was expressed in a language Billy just couldn't hold in his head and actually couldn't even pronounce well. In his mouth, the beautiful language took on the nature of pigs rooting at a trough. Certainly, there were other things he could have done in some official capacity for the church without the formality of Latin, but Billy didn't want that. He wanted to be a priest, offer absolution, actually change the bread into the body of Christ, the real body of Christ, not some imitation thing. He wanted to share it with the people of Charleston, the boys he grew up with. Have them call him father. Now that would be something. Other than this, he really didn't aspire to great things in the church or ask for anything from the church. Just to be a priest. That was all. Father Barry, Carl Malden in On the Waterfront. That's the kind of priest Billy told Charlie McClary he wanted to be.
A waterfront priest, Charlie? Like Father Barry, that's all. Listen to his speech in the hold of the ship. and anybody who sits around and lets it happen, keeps silent about something he knows has happened, shares the guilt of it just as much as the Roman soldier who pierced the flesh of our Lord to see if he was dead. Boys, this is my church, and if you don't think Christ is down here on the waterfront, you've got another guest coming. This is what I want to be, Charlie. Only not a waterfront priest, but maybe a sidewalk priest, yeah. A street corner priest in North Charleston or in the public house, and he could mix it up with the Negroes and the whites, crackers and Catholics alike, and help them work things out, find their way, bring them into the body of Christ. At least in the spirit, if not in the church. See that justice was done. That's it, Charlie. The sidewalks of downtown Charleston would do as his parish.
But like a movie, a celluloid image that flashed over and over again in Billy's mind, his life as Father Barry on the streets of Charleston was an illusion that was not going to happen. For ordination, some facility with Latin was required, and that was that. So, by mutual consent, Billy left the seminary, came back to Charleston, and took up driving a beer truck for Homer Fornaker at H&F Distributing, Inc. His normal route was to deadhead from Charleston to Charlotte, North Carolina, load up with beer, and return to Charleston. All in one long day. A very long and lonely day. Fornaker didn't mind if Billy took a rider on occasion to make the trip more bearable, and sometimes sent a passenger along himself who was going that way. Now, early March was basketball tournament time in the ACC, and when Billy learned that South Carolina was playing in Raleigh, he made Charlie McCleary a proposition. Billy and Charlie McCleary had three things in common. They had been close friends since childhood, both were Catholic, and both were passionate about South Carolina basketball. So over beers at the Gamecock Beer Parlor, Billy made a proposition to Charlie McCleary.
You go with me on my beer run to Charlotte. Charlie will load up and come back by way of Raleigh to take in the South Carolina game against NC State. One night stay over on the road, maybe that's all. Maybe not even that. Fornaker won't care. We'll be back in plenty of time for him to make the local distribution.
Just a minute, Billy. Let me check my busy schedule. Okay, what time?
2 days later, at 2 o'clock in the morning, Charlie McCleary pulled into the lot at H&F Distributing, Inc. and climbed into the cab of a 1951 Chevrolet 2-ton beer truck. It was old for such a workhorse, but it looked classy and ran smooth as silk. Painted green, it carried bright logos of Blatt's, Esslinger, and Pabst Blue Ribbon beer on each side. McCleary slid onto the bench seat next to Billy, pointed out the windshield, and said,
"Let's go!"
Gotta go by Fornaker's house before we hit the road. Get some paperwork from him, and he said there's something else he needs to tell me.
The Fornaker house at Isle of Palms was a modest wood frame structure. Painted white with a red roof, the yard was dominated by three ancient water oak trees that shaded a large porch wrapped around three sides of the house. For Isle of Palms, it was a rather modest house. At the door, the boys were met by Mr. Fornaker and led into an office off the parlor. There, in a plush living room chair pushed against a wall, sat a young girl. Arms on the rests, stiff and erect, she adopted the attitude of a queen on her throne. She wore a cheap, filmy dress in blue and pink, and a pink sweater a little light for March. Her eyes, gray and cold as granite, followed Billy and Charlie into the room. A small suitcase sat next to her.
"Boys, this here's Almira Foley. She's a daughter of one of my cousins from Tennessee. Been visiting with us for a while. I'd like for you boys to give her a ride to her aunt's house in Charlotte. Thought this would be a good idea. Save her from riding the Greyhound all alone. Elmira, this is Billy Fitzgerald. He was studying to be a priest once. Billy, who's your friend here?"
Billy heard nothing. He was staring at Elmira. She was standing next to the chair now, her fingers laced together below her stomach, pressing in on the filmy dress that was now outlining her thighs.
I'm Charlie McClary. Mr. Forniker, a friend of Billy's, we're gonna stop off at the basketball game in Augusta on the way back.
Well, that's fine. Billy told me that. Make good use of the trip. Here's the order for this trip, Billy. Now, Elmira, you just step out into the living room for just a minute. I want to talk to these boys.
Elmira picked up her suitcase and walked into the living room. Her dress swished against her legs and her dark brown hair boiled around her shoulders.
Close that door, will you, honey? Now, boys, I know I don't need to say this. You studying to be a priest and everything, Billy. But this is a gentle young girl here, and I don't want any rough talk or suggestive jokes, you hear? She's a nice young lady, and I don't want her honor besmirched in any way. You get my point?
Yes, sir. We understand.
Good. Now have a good trip. Deliver her to her Aunt Charlotte. She has the address.
Under the water oak trees, Elmira circled to the passenger side of the truck ahead of the boys.
Jesus, Billy. This is like one of those traveling salesman jokes. You know, I'm sorry, the farmer says. We have only two beds, and you have to sleep with my beautiful daughter. Here we are, 2:30 in the morning, and he says, sorry, boys, but you'll have to drive to Charlotte with my beautiful, whatever she is, sitting between you.
Don't swear like that, Charlie. She'll probably sleep all the way anyway.
She did sleep. On Highway 162, the truck rattled and shook, banged and hissed along at 50 miles an hour. The empty cargo area echoed every noise, and still she slept. On the bench between the two boys, her suitcase behind the seat, her knees splayed, she slept. Sliding down further and further on the bench, her dress slowly slid up her legs, distressingly slow. Revealingly slow, it slid.
Charlie, in the glove compartment is a rosary. We can say the beads while she's sleeping. We'll talk soft, won't bother her. I'll say the first decade.
For Billy, the church was all theater. A drama in which to play a part, to strike a pose, say a line or two. A play in which he knew the beginning and the end, the tragedy and the joy. He knew all the twists and turns of the plot and his place in its denouement. For Charlie McCleary, the church was all bedrock. Its moral strictures, sense of justice, sin and forgiveness, demand and promise were the foundation stones on which he based his life. He believed everything his church told him. What was wrong, what was right, what was good, what was bad. He believed and had built his life on this belief. But he never talked about the church. His faith was internal, personal, and one that would never know how strong it was unless the church, his core beliefs, were attacked in some way. Any attack on his church was a personal affront, and only then would he rise up and state his case, show his hand. It was ironic that the attack on the church he believed in, staked his life on, the church of the 1950s, was attacked from the inside. It was called Vatican II, and it pulled down all the old walls. But this was 1958 now, and the world was still in one piece. The gates of the citadel still standing, and so it made sense to say the rosary. Hurtling down a dark highway in a beer truck at over 50 miles an hour, a young girl asleep next to him, spread eagle, sliding down the seat, the skirt of her dress riding higher and higher, it made sense to say the rosary. Now, Billy was committed to the beads clunking against the steering wheel. But to say that he wasn't distracted, to say they both weren't distracted by the retreating blue and pink hemline would be an improbable lie. Each would find occasion to surreptitiously lean forward and adjust to a more comfortable sitting position, or fiddle with something on the dashboard. In the meantime, the rosary was said, and the skirt continued to barely hide from the boys one of the greater mysteries known to mankind. Between the rosary and the creeping dress, neither of the boys noticed that the truck was approaching 70 miles an hour until they heard the siren and the glare of flashing red lights filled the cab of the truck. The girl was awake now. She was sitting up straight, her knees firmly clenched, and her hem pulled down to a modest exposure. She looked at the boys with an expression that might have been contempt, or at least disdain. The truck pulled over, the local police car parked in behind, its red lights flashing. A tall, thin officer appeared in the open driver's side window of the cab.
Driver's license, please.
Driver's license examined, name written down. The officer then studied the three occupants of the truck. They sat stiff as stone, the rosary stowed in the glove compartment.
Are you okay, ma'am?
They tried to look up my dress.
Ma'am?
These boys tried to look up my dress. Both of them tried to look up my dress while they chanted some mumbo-jumbo.
The officer leaned in the window, looked at the two boys, and eased his hand back until it rested lightly on the butt of his gun.
You know these boys, ma'am?
I don't know either of them from Adam. They picked me up in Charleston this morning.
I'll have to ask y'all to step out of the truck, please. Just stand there. Stand there next to the cab.
Standing next to the cab now, the three faced the officer. There was another hour till sunrise, but the soft early glow of the advancing day, mixed with the thin morning mist, bathed the tableau in an eerie half-light. It was bright enough for the three to see the officer clearly. Elmira reached forward and touched the officer's gun.
Don't touch the gun, ma'am.
That's a big gun, ain't it? What's your name, officer? Oh, there it is, right on your shirt. Wayne, Officer Wayne.
It's Swain, ma'am. Officer Swain.
Well, that's what I said. Wayne, Officer Wayne. Are you going to arrest these boys, Officer Wayne? They tried to look up my dress. That's some kind of molestation, ain't it?
I think it's molestation, ma'am.
Well, I think so, too. They must be perverts. You going to arrest them?
No, ma'am. I think the word is molestation. You, Billy, you want to tell me what this is all about?
Well, officer, we did pick her up in Charleston and all, but we got her from her uncle, but he ain't really her uncle. I mean, they're related somehow. I work for him. Homer Fornaker, that's his name.
Fornaker?
Yes, sir. He owns H&F Distributing, Inc. We're delivering her to Charlotte for him. It's all legal. We're going to drop her off and pick up a load of beer, then we're going to the basketball game in Raleigh.
Fornaker?
That sure is a big gun, Officer Wayne. You ever take it out? Can I see it out of that holster? I'd like to touch it again.
Don't touch the gun, ma'am. I take it out only when I need to use it or to practice with it.
Small squeaks of stifled laughter pushed through the back of Charlie McCleary's fist pressed against his mouth. His face is turned away from the officer.
Could you take it out now, Officer Wayne? It looks so big.
Charlie McCleary has turned his back now and was doubled over. His right arm across his face, and his left circled his stomach. His body was convulsed with silent laughter. Petrified, Billy Fitzgerald stood straight, looking at the officer. He had no clue.
No, ma'am. What's the matter with him? Charlie, isn't it? Is he sick or something?
No, I think he just had a little stroke of enlightenment.
Enlightenment, ma'am. I think the word's enlightenment. Listen. Y'all need to follow me to the station in Camden. I want to make a few phone calls to verify your story. Do you want to ride with me, ma'am? Might have something you might want to say to me in private.
Okay, but only if I can hold your gun.
At this point, Charlie McCleary lost it completely and has leaned on the open truck window convulsed with laughter. Billy Fitzgerald, still clueless, hasn't moved.
You go ahead and ride with the boys, ma'am.
At the station, duty officer Cook's phone call to H&F Distributing, Inc. confirmed the beer pickup story, and Fornaker himself verified the rightful presence of the girl. But there was still the matter of her claim of molestation.
So let me get this straight. Now, Miss Foley was asleep in the cab of the truck on the seat between the you two boys, and she slid down into the seat in a way, well, that her legs were spread apart, and hem of her dress was hiked way up, and you boys kept fidgeting around, trying to get a look further up her legs. All the while, you were saying the rosary. Is that right? I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this. I mean, Miss Foley woke up. She saw the state that she was in, and saw that you were taking a peek at her. Clearly she was upset, and, well, you certainly were taking advantage of her, weren't you? Am I right so far?
Yes, sir, Mr. Cook, but we didn't intend to take advantage of her condition. It was just hard not to look.
Well, I understand that you didn't touch her. You didn't touch her dress, is that right?
That's right. We were busy with the rosary.
Ah, the rosaries again. Well, Miss Foley, do you want to bring charges against these boys? I mean, I'm not sure what they would be. I mean, there's no physical evidence of assault or contact, and they didn't make up the circumstances. But, of course, we take these matters seriously.
No, Officer Cook, no charges, please. These are just two dumb boys who found themselves at Temptation's door. They couldn't open it no further, and they couldn't close it neither. They did learn something here, though, and I trust them. They're really good boys. I'll just go on to Charlotte with them to my aunt. If they get funny, I'll chase out them beads and make them start counting.
It was full morning when the H&F Distributing, Inc. beer truck pulled out of the parking lot next to the Camden Police Station and made its way towards Highway 162. The March sun was hazy in its rising, and the light was flat and without vigor. The pale sun slanted across the road, creating muted shadows that passed over the truck like so many ghosts from the past. Elmira Foley was once again between the two boys. The rosary beads tucked safely in the glove compartment waited their turn again. Billy Fitzgerald, alert as he ever got, hunched up over the steering wheel and turned the truck onto the highway towards Charlotte. Straight like a ribbon drawn tight, the flat, nondescript road crawled towards them, passed under the truck, and snapped away into the distance. The past is past, it seemed to say. This is to come.
How long to Charlotte, Billy?
2 hours, maybe a little less.
I ain't going to my aunt's, you know. You ain't taking me there.
What? That's what Fornaker said. We're to drop you at your aunt's.
Fornaker don't know nothing. Actually knows everything, but I ain't going back there. You take me to Salisbury. I got a cousin in Salisbury.
Salisbury? Charlie, we're not going to Salisbury.
Yes, you are.
Her hand is braced against the dashboard.
You're taking me. You're going to Raleigh to that basketball game, and Salisbury is most on the way. You'll take me there, deliver me from this. You boys are Catholic, ain't you? And you believe in hell? I'm Baptist. Got dunked in the river with some other girls, real proper-like. Sang in the choir, too. Preacher there, that's up in Bridgeville, Tennessee, he was all hellfire and damnation. Never a Sunday service or Wednesday night prayer meeting passed that we wasn't all going straight to hell. Thought he had us all scared to death. That preacher, though, he didn't know nothing about hell.
It was Billy she was talking to now, but still not facing him. Looking straight ahead, pulling up the past out of that muddy Tennessee town she came from, dredging up a small dirt road house back in the woods. Talking to Billy, but dumping it all out on the dashboard of the truck.
You don't know nothing about hell either. All them fancy torment pictures I seen in books. Tell you what hell is, and it ain't no fiery place off in the beyond. It ain't no place at all. Hell is right here. Hell is a 14-year-old girl laying awake in her bed every night listening for her daddy's feet scuffing up the hall at 2:30 in the morning. Every night she's praying to Jesus she won't hear them feet, praying she won't have to face them across the breakfast table the next morning. And when that old brother, sitting at the same table, knows what's going on. Her mama fussing about the kitchen. She knows, too. But she's too scared to say nothing and ain't gonna do nothing. The kids on the school bus and at school, they all knowed. Everybody knowed what he was doing. They would look at me funny. Whisper back and forth when I got on the bus. All I wanted to do was stand in the aisle and yell at them all. It ain't my fault! It ain't my fault!
Elmira was crying now, pushing tears out of her eyes with fists that served only to spread the dampness about her face. She leaned over and with the hem of her dress wiped the wet away. Billy took his hand off the wheel and made to touch her shoulder. Almost he does. But then he pulled his arm away and placed his hand back on the wheel.
So it was my fault. That's what their eyes said when they looked at me. That's what everybody believed. What I come to believe? My fault? My fault? Somehow I caused him to do it. I didn't mean to, but it was my doing what that boy caused him to. He was just a boy, Billy, 16, but he had a car. You understand that? He had a car, and every girl in town wanted to get in that car, just ride away in that car. Then outside the movie show one night, he picked me. Bunch of us were standing there, hot, my God, it was hot, deciding where to go next, and he pulled up in that car. Window down, leaning out, chin on his elbow, nonchalant, like racing that motor. His black stringy hair falling into one eye, and he asked me would I like a ride home. Billy, it was like James Dean himself had stopped in that black 49 Mercury we just saw in the movie and asked me if I wanted a ride. I would have rid that car right off the cliff with him that night if he'd have asked. I looked at the other girls standing around, their eyes big as saucers, flipped my hair, and slid myself into that car. We drove out to the lake and parked. I'd done that before, but this was different somehow. I know it was wrong, but I wanted to do it. You know, I wanted to do everything. It was just a feeling, kind of overwhelming. But I didn't really know nothing about it except for the girl talk and the health book pictures at school. Turns out he didn't know much more than I did, and we sort of made a mess of it. Lots of twisted clothes and thrashing around. It was more embarrassed than anything. But in an awkward way, you might say, we got it done.
Elmira turned from the dash and looked at Billy. She wasn't smiling, but there was a look of clarity in her face, a brightness in her eyes, the face she wore when she was teasing the policeman. It was as though she held a secret now, a profound secret that came to her in the back seat of a green Chevy.
I know it was wrong, Billy, but it didn't seem like it was wrong, no matter what the preacher says. I'm ashamed to say it now, but it was kind of fun. Something that was natural-like. We was laughing when it was over.
Then suddenly she turned back to the empty road, the white ribbon disappearing under the truck. The open look of possibility, the look of almost hopefulness, snapped away.
He was waiting for me in the kitchen when I got home. Sitting in the dark, a cigarette lighting up his face when he took a draw, drinking a beer. He was waiting on me. Turn on the light, he said. How long did it go on? A year? 2 years? I turned the light on and just stood by the door. Held my little clutch bag in front of me, low, like I needed to hide myself. My hair was a mess, lipstick smeared all over my face, and my blouse was half untucked from my skirt. You've been with that boy, ain't you, Elmira? He said. You think I don't know? I knowed as soon as you got in that car. You're used now, girl. Like a dirty rag, you're used. I can smell it on you. The foul smell of what you've been doing. You got to pay now. He got up, grabbed my wrist, and slapped me. That's when it started. You ever live in hell for 2 years? It's forever. Then one night, I took a knife from the kitchen and hid it in the bed. When he come, when he wasn't thinking about nothing but what he was doing, I cut him. I cut him real good. I told everybody it was an accident in the woodshed, and they shipped me off to Uncle Fornica in Charleston. Now they expect me to go back? But I ain't going back. I ain't never going back. Billy, you're taking me to Salisbury, Billy.
Yes, Elmira. Yes. Charlotte first, then Salisbury, then Raleigh. Right, Charlie?
My cousin in Salisbury, she works for a radio station. Has a big job herself and says she can get me on there, too. Says I might even get to sing on the air. Imagine that, Billy, if I could just get to sing on the radio. My voice going out on nothing but air. The thousands listening to me sing. I'm going to school, too. Learn to talk like real people. Like them radio people, so I can talk on the air, too. You're going to take me there, Billy, I know it. Load this truck with beer in Charlotte, then you take me to Salisbury. Okay, I'm going to go to sleep now and think about Salisbury and that radio. Don't neither of you look up my skirt.
With that, she gave Billy a light tap on the shoulder with her fist, then settled back in the seat and was quickly asleep. Billy didn't know why he did it, didn't know what prompted him. No hands had been placed on his head to sanction him to forgive the sin of another person. No words said, spoken in Latin even, to give him the right to utter a word, a formula, that would wipe clean the slate of anyone who opened their heart to him. In fact, that hand had been withheld. Unworthy, it said. But all are unworthy, aren't they? And if he is unworthy of such a trust, then what does it mean to be worthy? And what is a priest, if nothing but a man? If we can't absolve each other, extend the grace of God to those who reach out to us, then by whom and by what right is that simple human act of compassion extended or withheld? No. No hands of authority had been placed on his head, and yet he reached out. In this moment, no consideration of authority passed his mind. Nothing of right or wrong, just like Father Barry, kneeling in the hold of the ship. A man first, then a priest. A need was placed before him, and that old hunger to set things right in the world rose up in him. Or perhaps it didn't even matter why he did it. But Billy put his hand on Elmira Foley's shoulder.
Et ego te absolvo a peccatis tui. In nomine Patri e Filii e Spiritus Sancti.
And so it was done. For whatever reason, it was done. He spoke the absolution so lightly that even Charlie barely heard him. But he did hear.
That was good, Billy. Pretty, even.
Well, it should be. I heard it often enough.
But what's the penance, Billy? There's always the penance.
Look at her, Charlie. Leaning on me. Her head in my shoulder. Sleeping the sleep of innocence. The penance? The penance is the sin itself.
The sin? It's plural, though, Billy. Peccatis is plural, isn't it? Means sins. I absolve you of your sins. You said sin like it's only one.
Yeah, they got it wrong. There's only one sin, and all others follow from that one.
Well, what was her sin then, Billy? She didn't do anything wrong. Maybe with that boy, but who would say that was a sin?
Billy felt the weight of Elmira's body. He heard again, felt again, his mother's sigh. The sigh that echoed with disappointment marked his failure. He gripped the steering wheel and looked down at Highway 162. Narrow, straight, and flat. Relentless, the earth turning pulled everything toward them.
Being human. The sin of being the miserable, imperfect, disappointing creatures we are. Isn't that enough? Everything else follows from that. We had the choice and we chose the knowledge of good and evil. And the penance? You asked what the penance is. Well, we ain't in the garden anymore, are we? No more innocence. And the penance? It's the pain of knowing what we are.
The air in the truck was clean and clear now, sparkling even, as though a cleansing rain had washed the earth around the cab. Ego te absolvo, echoed in Billy's mind. Ego te absolvo. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. Ego te absolvo. And Billy wondered who was out there to forgive him. Who would relieve him of his great failing? Then the look of impotence on his face dissolved. Like a scene in a film, it dissolved. Then resolved to form into something called determination. He lifted his hand from the wheel and snatched at the air as though catching a moth. All his misfortune. The disappointment of his mother, his failure, sins past and those he knew awaited him, he caught. Pulled from the air, he scrunched them into a little ball and pitched it over his shoulder. And now the penance, he said. The truck still pounded on the road to Charlotte. still creaked and groaned with the noise of its labor. But inside the cab there was a quietness now, a silence almost profound in its weight. Elmira slept. So there was Charlotte, and then there was Salisbury. Then the truck stopped, not in the town, but next to an open field in the woods on the approach. Elmira slid from the truck in the evening light and looked at the radio station down the long, dusty, two-rut driveway. A small sign posted at her feet said, WROA, 5:40 a.m., the heart of Rowan County. We're all family here and all country all the time. The station didn't look anything like her cousin's description. This one sat alone in the middle of the field. There were no real trees to speak of, just a few scrub oaks that eked out a living here and there among patches of sand spurs and palmettos. The radio station itself was little more than a large, single-wide house trailer anchored to concrete block piers. The top half was clad in a silver metallic siding, aluminum, and the bottom half in blue-green vinyl panels, neither dark nor light, perhaps Mediterranean. Parked in front and to the left side of the trailer was a dusty maroon 1955 four-door Chevrolet, and looming behind the trailer, a tall metal frame that could be identified as an antenna. The boys watched Elmira, backlit by the descending sun, walk up the dirt drive and mount the trailer's three steps. She paused a moment, opened the single door, turned and waved. Then the door closed behind her.
She going to be okay, Charlie?
She'll be okay. She knows who she is.
A great thanks to all of our cast of characters. Mike Murphy as our narrator, Matt Hatfield as Billy Fitzgerald, Judy Hearn, whom you heard before the drama, as both Mrs. Fitzgerald, Billy's mother, and also Elmira Foley, Jim King as Charlie McCleary, Tom Welch as Homer Fornacre, your host as Officer Swain, Don Rush as Duty Officer Cook. Habits of Devotion was adapted from a short story of the same name written by your host. Thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Radio Theater. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.